Okay. We're having a bit of a computer problem. I couldn't get the computer on here, and I don't know what the problem with it is. But the outline for today is available on the course website. Basically, what I'm going to be talking about today is the period from 1939, the outbreak of the war in 1939, to the globalization of the war in 1941. Because what starts out as a European war, a war between Germany and the Western powers over Poland in September 1939, develops into a global conflict, first with the German invasion of the Soviet Union in June of 1941. Is this loud enough? And then with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, and the outbreak of the war between the United States and Japan, war in the Pacific, which is followed 4 days later by a German declaration of war in the United States. So the United States enters the war, not just against Japan, but against Germany as well, in December of 1941, right? And our problem today is to understand this period. You know, how did the war spread? Why was it that what started out as a purely European conflict, in a sense even a local conflict by the standards of what happened by December of 1941, how did that conflict between Germany and the Western powers develop into this global war? And again, we have this standard view that you find in the general culture. No problem, very easy to understand. Here you have these two extremely aggressive countries, Germany and Japan, Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan. Want to understand American entry into the Second World War? Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. That explains it. Okay. Why did Germany come in? They were allies with Japan. Germany was also an evil country, so naturally they would want to go to war with the United States. Simple as that. We're going to see today it's not as simple as that. And we're going to see that by bringing international relations theory to bear. Because if you have any familiarity with higher theory at all, there's something very perplexing about this whole story. It doesn't make sense. So here you have Japan, bogged down as it was in this unwinnable war with China, because Japan had basically embarked on this war designed to transform China into a kind of satellite of Japan in 1937. And China is this absolutely enormous country. It's like, you know, and even though the Japanese were making an extraordinary military effort, it was beyond their ability to bring China to heel. This war was unwinnable, and it was recognized as such in Japanese ruling circles that the war with China was unwinnable in a military sense, that their only hope was some sort of political settlement with at least some faction in China. So they bogged down in this war with China. They're going to gratuitously, out of sheer aggressiveness, you know, go to war with what was by far the strongest country in the world in terms of its mobilizable war potential, a country the Japanese would be utterly incapable of conquering, namely the United States. It doesn't make sense. They may be aggressive, but are they lunatics? Countries don't behave suicidally. These are kind of assumptions that you bring to bear if you're exposed to international relations theory. You know, countries don't behave totally irrationally. In parapolitical terms, they do things that have to make sense. And the same sort of point about Germany in 1941. Here, Germany is still involved in this European war after having invaded Russia and failed to really bring Russia to heel. The Germans are going to, again, gratuitously go to war with the United States. If you recall, that's what A.J.P. Taylor claimed in the very last page of his book, the book that we talked about last time. You know? He said Hitler gratuitously destroyed the basis for his success by widening the conflict. He gratuitously attacked the Soviet Union and then gratuitously attacked the United States. Two countries that asked, quote, only to be left alone. Now that doesn't make sense from the standpoint of international relations theory. Why would Hitler do it? He has his hands full in Russia. Why would he gratuitously go to war with the United States? And could it possibly be that the United States and Russia were two countries that just asked only to be left alone? They didn't care at all about what was going on outside their borders. You know, if you look at international politics through the lens of international relations theory, you say, it just can't be. Countries have to be concerned with what's going on outside their borders. They have to be concerned with the structure of power and the world in which they reside. There's no possibility of just picking up and going to the moon. Newt Gingrich's talk about colonies up there notwithstanding. Maybe evil, but are they crazy? Do you ever get to control the policy of a great nation by just thumbing your nose at power political realities, not concerning yourself at all with what would happen in a war, just plunging yourself into a conflict because you like war for its own sake without regard to whether you have any chance of winning or not? It doesn't make sense, all right? That insight points you to a set of problems. It's like a loose thread in the fabric of the conventional wisdom. And you start pulling on that loose thread and everything begins to unravel. It's not pure aggressiveness. There's a story here. It's the same sort of point that Sontag was making. Those passages I read to you at the beginning of the lecture last time. This war of 1939, this wasn't a war that Hitler intended at the start of the Polish crisis. He had hoped to put off the conflict to a much later date, 43-45 period. There's a story here, a story that has to do with more than just the aggressiveness of the aggressor countries. Those are the instincts that you kind of bring to bear. So what happens? So we want to reconstruct the story as a way of getting some feel for this issue. How does international politics work? Is it to be understood in terms of aggression? Or is there something more complicated there? Is there a logic underlying the course of events that has to do with the way international politics works in general, the way a system based on power works in general. So we want to reconstruct the story. And what happened in the war between Germany and the Western powers? Well, the most important event in the first year of the war was the fall of France in the spring of 1940, May and June of 1940. Unexpected. No one expected France to fall, not even the Germans themselves. When the war broke out, they didn't even have a plan for successful campaign in the West. Important difference between 1939 and 1914. No equivalent to the Schlieffen Plan in 1939. And the plan that led to the defeat of France was actually improvised in the course of the war. improvised in part because the French had captured certain German couriers who had been carrying the previous German plan. So the Germans knew that they had to change their plan, and they improvised this plan, which actually led to the defeat of France. And that was and then there's the second event that you should know about, and that took place during this period, was the German attack on the Soviet Union in June of 1941, a year later. Isolated events? Or can we insert these things into a story? There is a story here, and to make sense of this story, we have to look at the policy of this country that, according to Taylor, asked only to be left alone, the United States of America. Big myth that the United States was this isolationist country that it was fed up with Europe, it didn't care about European affairs, turned its back on Europe, asked only to be left alone. It was the United States of President Franklin Roosevelt, who, as you know, had been elected president in 1932 in the midst of the Great Depression. His energies had been focused on America's domestic economic problems. Okay. A country that asked only to be left alone. Well, when the war broke out, the United States had this neutrality legislation in place. And the whole idea of the neutrality legislation was to prevent the United States from slipping into a new world war the same way that she had slipped into the First World War, not knowing what she was doing. Neutrality legislation, one of the main goals of it was to make sure that if the United States got involved, it would be as a result of a conscious decision rather than because a situation had developed where the American economy was dependent on a certain set of belligerents and economic dependence conditioned the behavior of the political leadership in a way that they were no longer free agents to base policy on the nationalist. That was the, you know, one of the driving forces behind the neutrality legislation. One of the key figures here is a man named Walter Millis, who wrote a very influential book called Road to War about America's entry in the First World War. And it's just done for all the wrong reasons, according to Millis. That book came out, I think, in 1935. It was like one of the basic, you know, Bibles of the isolationist movement, or at least the movement that led to the passage of the neutrality legislation. But in 1940, Millis was an interventionist. He was the editorial writer for the New York Herald Tribune, the country's second most important newspaper at that time. And he saw no contradiction there. He said, if we do it, we should do it for the right reasons, not in this a totally half-assed way, the way we did it in 1917. American policy, the beginning of the war was, we don't have to worry too much. Because the neutrality legislation, at least for the time being, allowed us to, in effect, support the Western democracies. Why was that? Because it was cash and carry neutrality. The Europeans, anyone who wanted to, could come to American ports and buy American goods and American munitions and so on, but they'd have to carry them in their own ships and pay for them with their own money rather than with borrowed money. Right? Who did this favor? Britain and France. Why? Because they controlled the seas. So you can have your cake and eat it too. You know, you can pretend that you're neutral, but you could actually be favoring the Western powers. And the hope was that the Western powers, the assumption was, Western powers, they might not be able to beat Germany quickly, but as long as they weren't overrun, as long as they weren't defeated, then America was secure. As long as Britain and France, you know, kind of kept Germany at bay and prevented Germany from dominating all the resources of Europe and constructing, you know, with those resources, such vast military power that America herself would ultimately be threatened. You know, as long as British and French power remained intact, America could relax. The local great powers could balance Germany. But the fall of France basically punctured that illusion and led to a certain change in American policy. You know, the increase in interventionism, the sense that here the British were all alone now, they need, they, you know, if Britain went under, that would be terrible for the United States. Maybe we should support Britain, but with measures short of war. And again, you know, support Britain, but keep America out of war. Indeed, support Britain with measures that might lead to war, but at the same time telling, we could tell ourselves that we don't want a war. That's the attitude in this period after the fall of France. And you find a certain evolution in U.S. policy. The President Roosevelt, in 1940, he's campaigning for an unprecedented third term. And the election, of course, takes place in November of 1940. And there's a lot of isolationist sentiment in the country. And Roosevelt has to take this sentiment into account, even though he himself is an isolationist. So you find him doing things like the famous destroyers for bases deal. This was September of 1940, 2 months before the election. What was this deal? We would provide the British with so-called overage American destroyers, which they needed for the anti-submarine war to keep control of the Atlantic. And in exchange for that, they would provide us with rights to build bases on British possessions in the Western Hemisphere, especially in the Caribbean. And said, well, this was you could sell this to the country. This is in America's interest. We have an interest in hemispheric defense. These basing rights are, you know, supportive of an essentially defensive policy, drawing a line on the Western Hemisphere. You know, everyone kind of supported that. But in a sense, you'd also be supporting the British through the back door. So you find an evolution of American policy during this period, by no means complete. And after the election, which Roosevelt wins, you have a further evolution of U.S. policy because Roosevelt has freer hands. I should just say that there's this whole myth that in democracies, the policy-making process is transparent, that the people understand what the government is doing. It's not quite true. Because governments in democracies have an interest in framing their policies in such a way that their domestic publics are going to find palatable. Especially during the election campaign, Roosevelt used a lot of isolationist rhetoric that was totally at variance with his basic thinking and the policy that he intended to pursue, indeed, to pursue after he won re-election. So you have, shortly after he's re-elected, sworn in for his third term in January, Congress passing what was called Lend-Lease. Lend-Lease meant that we were going to supply the British with whatever they needed, and we weren't going to worry too much about how they would finance it. We would take care of the financing. Worry about these financial aspects after the war was over. Okay? What's the implication? You're getting in a step deeper. Why? Because you're not going to provide the British with all these goods and then just allow German submarines to sink the ships that are carrying over to Britain. If you're going to supply them with goods, then the shipping lanes have to be defended as well. But if you're going to defend the shipping lanes, doesn't that mean that you're going to start shooting at German submarines? And who knows where that's going to lead? This is this policy of half in, half out, you know, go as far as the political situation will support, you know, a little bit of duplicity and so on. This was not just the Roosevelt policy, but it was actually congenial to the American people at this point. Okay? Why is this stuff important? Because of its effect on German policy. The Germans understood that the United States was not a country that asked only to be left alone. The Germans understood that the Americans would be concerned about the prospect of the total destruction of British power and the domination of Eurasia by Germany. Why? Because in such a case, the Germans would be able to organize the vast economic resources of Europe under German control and transform the economic surplus that they could draw from those resources into military power that would ultimately challenge the United States. Germans could first penetrate West Africa down to the Bulge, and then it's a short hop, really, from Dakar in West Africa to the Brazilian Bulge. Germans are actually closer to Brazil than the Americans are. And once you start penetrating South America, you know, the United States would be isolated. So all this stuff would have a dramatic long-term effect on our security. We had to kind of do something about it. It was clear to Hitler that Roosevelt wanted to get involved more and more deeply, certainly to the extent of preventing the British from collapsing. Probably further than that. But certainly the United States would not countenance a German-dominated Europe in the long run. But Roosevelt couldn't move full speed ahead in pursuit of that sort of policy because it was kept back, for the time being at least, by domestic political forces. Who knows how long those forces would be able to restrain Roosevelt. What that meant was that Germany had a certain window of opportunity within which to act, to move ahead without worrying too much about American involvement. And where should Germany move ahead? Clearing the decks in the east. If Germany didn't do anything about Soviet power in the east, and then simply waited for the Americans to intervene in the war, then the Soviets would see that Germany's hands were tied in the west, and then they could start putting pressure, increasing pressure on Germany in the east, playing between Germany and the Western powers. The Germans had to make themselves secure. They couldn't be dependent on Soviet goodwill, because they see an American intervention looming in the future there. So they wanted to clear the decks in the east before the Americans came in. And it's this America factor that plays the key role in the timing of the German attack on the Soviet Union. Hitler says very explicitly, right after Pope Francis's, that they have a year in which to plan for the invasion of the Soviet Union and to invade Russia, because they can't wait too long, because otherwise America would intervene. Window logic, right? Window of opportunity for Germany. They see it closing because they see America getting involved. This is what pushes them ahead. The America factor is of fundamental importance. And I should say that this is one of the kind of principal points that's emerged from historical work on this period. A very fine German scholar named Andreas Hilgruber had an important article on the American factor in German policy in this period. But much more important than that even was this phenomenal book that came out a few years ago by a British scholar named Adam Tooze, and it's called Wages of Destruction. And it just shows you the degree to which concerns about the United States and the involvement of American power in European affairs were driving German policy in this period. So I think actually this is like the most important historical work on the origins of the Second World War that's come out in the last 30 or 40 years. Really a remarkable piece of work. It's an economic historian. All right, what is the effect of this? As Germany is being pushed in that direction, it has an effect on American policy. Because the more Germany moves ahead, the greater risk there is for the United States. If we just sit on our hands and allow Hitler to create this German-dominated Europe, to conquer all of Russia, to organize the resources of all of Eurasia, then Germany is going to become unconquerable. The problem is going to become unmanageable if you just wait. So that immediately after the German invasion of the Soviet Union, you have a quickening of the pace. Roosevelt becomes much more interested in intervening in Europe. Right? in getting the United States involved. He has this problem with domestic political opinion, and his way of dealing with it is to be, this is what he tells Churchill when he and the British Prime Minister Winston Churchill meet off the coast of Newfoundland in the Atlantic Conference in August of 1941. And Churchill reports this to the British cabinet, a remarkable document, because Roosevelt is much more open with Churchill than he is with his subordinates. He says, he intends to become more and more provocative in the naval war. Because the United States is playing a greater and greater role in protecting the convoys that are supplying them. More and more provocative, in terms of attacking German submarines and other German naval vessels. And if the Germans don't like that, well, then they can declare war on America. His goal is to provoke the Germans into declaring war against America, because that way you can say, oh, well, we're going into the war because we ourselves have been attacked. Right? Not as an, the real reason is you want to prevent Germany from dominating all of Europe, and so that's why you want to intervene as rapidly as possible. I should say, this is not just construction. This was the sort of thinking that was taking place in top U.S. military circles during this period. There's a guy named Mark Stoller, has a very nice book on the U.S. military during this period. He kind of basically nails down the whole story. One of the key figures is the chief of naval operations. His name is Admiral Stark, Hal Stark. And he comes up with this very important document toward the end of 1940. It's called the Plan Dog document, where he kind of gives all the different options for the United States. Foreshadowing intervention against Germany, he says. Germany's the real threat. And this culminates in an extremely important document called the Victory Program. That's what everyone called it. Of September 11th, 1941, right? 60 years to the day before the attacks on New York and Washington. And this is of interest because this Victory Program is an argument essentially for preventive war. Everyone says, oh, the United States would never dream of preventive war. Well, the whole notion is we can't just wait until Germany really builds up her power, until Germany, controls all these resources of Russia, until Germany, brings order out of the chaos in the occupied areas within Russia, which they calculate will take about 2 years. So if we wait until that happens, then the problem is going to become unmanageable. If we wait until Germany attacks the United States, then the situation is hopeless. Therefore, we have to move while it's still strategically feasible for us to move. We can't wait until Germany brings order out of chaos in Russia. We have to move much earlier than that while Germany is still vulnerable, while Germany still has her hands full. It's an argument for intervention in the war against Germany. And the military, who thinks along these lines, says, let's focus on Germany. Let's not divide our attention between Germany and Japan. Let's remain at peace with Japan so we don't have to fight two wars, so they could just concentrate on the war against Germany. This is the argument of the Victory Program. It's an interventionist argument. It's not just an argument about how we should fight the war if we get involved. It's an argument that we should get involved earlier rather than later. Because to wait too long would be disastrous. Better sooner than later. Standard preventive war sorts of arguments. Okay? Roosevelt wants to pursue that sort of policy. Right? His dream would have been to get the United States involved in the war with Germany without having to fight Japan at the same time. But the problem is that even though the United States becomes more and more provocative in the naval war that's going on in the North Atlantic in the second half of 1941, a famous incident called the Greer Incident, again, Roosevelt goes to the country on September 11th, 1941, that same date, and he gives this fireside chat announcing that the United States Navy has adopted a policy of shooting first, supposedly in reaction to what the Germans have done. It says, when you see a rattlesnake coiled up to strike, you don't wait for him to strike. You strike first, he says. Again, this is, you know, people, you know, the reason I'm kind of dwelling on this aspect of it is people think that the George W. Bush policy of preemption, as they called it, was totally new and unprecedented and a total break with American tradition. It turns out it's not true at all. Right? This is that same kind of thinking. And of course, you know, no one criticizes it because we sympathize with the whole notion of the intervention in the war against Hitler. Okay. So Roosevelt tries to be provocative, but Hitler's not biting. Yeah. He has his hands full with this war against Russia. The last thing he wants is a second war against the United States. His Navy says, we can't just allow the Americans to do this with impunity. We, you know, they're bellicose, we should accept that. Hitler just orders his admirals in very clear terms to avoid taking action that would justify an American declaration of war against Germany. Because he knows that Roosevelt is held back to a certain degree by domestic opinion. And he doesn't want to play into Roosevelt's hands. Situation frustrating for Roosevelt. How does he deal with it? This is where the whole analysis of the U.S.-Japan conflict in 1941 comes into play. And it took me a long time to sort this business out, but the whole story is quite extraordinary. And on the course website and in the readings for this week, I put a chapter from a book I wrote, and this chapter deals with the whole question of how you go about understanding American involvement in the Second World War, American policy in 1941. And if you want to see a lot of the evidence supporting the argument I'm going to put forward to you, you know, you can look that up. By the way, someone asked me about the supplementary readings that I posted on the course website, and whether you're supposed to read them, you'll be tested on them for the exam. No, it's purely optional, purely voluntary. It's just for those people who are interested in going into these things in greater depth. They're there for you to read, but you're not by any means required to read it. You have to be tested on it. We have the problem of understanding Pearl Harbor and how it fits into the story. U.S. policy in the run-up to the Pacific War? Is this the sort of policy you would expect from an isolationist country? A country that asked only to be left alone? A country that was preoccupied with its internal problems? No. Again, it's like the same point about the naval war, you know, Roosevelt's provocative policy in the North Atlantic. The United States had a very active policy vis-a-vis Japan. What was the key development in this policy? On July 26, 1941, the United States slaps an embargo on Japan. And what were we embargoing? The most important commodity that was being embargoed was oil. I mean, it's very hard to believe now, but the United States in those days was actually an exporter of oil. California was an exporter of oil. You, if you're ever coming back from the airport north on La Cienega, you look in the right, you can still see some of those old oil wells pumping away. It wasn't just the United States that was slapping on this embargo. America's friends, the British and the Dutch, who controlled the rest of the world's oil supplies, cooperated with the embargo. No oil for Japan. And why was this important? It wasn't because Japan had an oil-based economy. For industrial purposes, Japan basically used coal, which they could mine in Manchuria, which they controlled since 1931. Oil, liquid fuels, were needed for military and especially for naval purposes. They were needed because without it, the whole Japanese military force, the military effort in China would grind to a halt because modern armies need liquid fuels. And if, Japan was basically choked off of oil supplies in that way, the whole Japanese military effort was already, you know, difficult shape. It would become hopeless, and for the Japanese to accept that would be tantamount to simply writing off China. Okay? The oil embargo played a very important role in the run-up to the war. But by the way, note the date. Soviets are invaded in June, oil embargo July. You have to think, is there a connection? Why is the oil embargo important? The Japanese needed to get the oil supplies resumed, because otherwise the Japanese effort in China would just totally collapse. Total humiliation. They had lost hundreds of thousands of lives in China. Very hard for a government to just walk away from it. There are two ways in which they could get the oil supplies to resume. One way is through negotiations with Washington. And the Japanese tried very hard. August, September, October, November 1941 to negotiate some sort of arrangement with the Americans. There's this attempt which our ambassador in Tokyo, Joseph Gru, took very seriously on the part of the Japanese Prime Minister, Prince Konoya, to have a leaders' conference with Roosevelt on American territory. And Konoya made it known to Gru that he would accept the American terms, whatever they were. But the Americans are not interested in the leaders' conference. This leads to the collapse of the Konoya government and its replacement with a government headed by War Minister General Tojo, in which the foreign minister's name was Togo Shigemori. And their mandate was to look at this whole problem with fresh eyes. And they came up, Togo basically came up, we managed to get the cabinet to support him on this, with this plan for modus vivendi. Modus vivendi was simply turning back the clock to where it had been before the Americans slapped on the oil embargo. The Americans embargoed the delivery of oil after the Japanese had moved, with the consent of the French authorities, into southern Indochina in late July 1941. Right? Japanese said, we will withdraw from southern Indochina. You provide us with the same level of oil deliveries that you had provided us with before we moved into southern Indochina. I mean, this is not just containment. This is containment plus. The Japanese are offering to withdraw. We will negotiate with China under your auspices. In principle, these were not absurd terms. The Japanese were really accommodating to American power, as you would expect they would. But the Americans are not interested in this. Okay. Turn a deaf ear to the leaders' conference and to the proposal for the modus vivendi, also called Plan B. Okay. That's one route that's closed off. What's the other route for getting the oil supplies to resume? They could use military force. The Dutch East Indies, as Indonesia was called in those days, was within easy striking range of the Japanese forces now in southern Indochina. The Dutch could offer no resistance. They don't even have a home government of their own to support them, Holland having been overrun by the Nazis. But the Americans had made it clear that a move against the Indies would mean war with the United States. So in either case, the Japanese are faced with this choice. Accept total defeat in China, capitulating over China, or face war with the United States. Their backs are to the wall. That's the background of Pearl Harbor. It's not an act of gratuitous aggression. Right. The real issue here is, how is American policy to be understood? by pursuing the policy you did, the policy of the oil embargo, the Americans were basically putting the United States on a collision course with Japan. Okay? Everyone admits this is the case. All historians have written on this. They understand that this was the effect of the oil embargo. But they refuse to accept the idea that this was a deliberate policy on Roosevelt's part. Effect is not the same as intent. Well, how do you square the circle? They admit that the oil embargo is putting the two countries on a collision course, but they say this war with Japan was the last thing the United States wanted. Above all, if as you know, as the majority view among historians, it seemed that that Roosevelt really wanted to take the United States into the war against Germany. It didn't make sense if that was your goal, to have a second war against Japan. Okay, how do they square the circle? Well, if you look at the historical literature, they do it in two ways. One is to say that Roosevelt didn't understand the consequences of his own policy. This is the argument of ignorance. He didn't understand what the oil embargo meant, how it would push the Japanese against the wall. So Japanese would never dare attack a country as strong as the United States. We could do what we wanted with Japan with impunity. This is a claim that people make. And then there's the other claim, which is, whether Roosevelt understood it or not, the problem was that he had lost control over American policy. Policy had been hijacked by the bureaucracy, by second-tier bureaucrats, people like Assistant Secretary of State Dean Acheson, who, without Roosevelt's knowledge, transformed what Roosevelt intended originally to be just a kind of a licensing agreement where the oil supplies to Japan would be subject to U.S. control but would continue, into an outright embargo. And by the time Roosevelt and his Secretary of State Cordell Hull found out what was going on in September, it was too late to do anything about it. Those are the two basic arguments. That latter argument, the bureaucratic politics argument, the argument that the bureaucracy had basically hijacked policy, that's the argument of the Utley book, right? It's like very important when you go home to use those same techniques that I explained when I was talking about Taylor last time to analyze the Utley book, right? Because his argument is that the political leadership lost control of policy. It was hijacked. The bureaucracy had taken over. If true, this would be an extremely important argument, because we like to think we live in a democracy. But what kind of democracy is it when the politically responsible leaders no longer have control of policy, and policy could be hijacked by these irresponsible bureaucrats? Right? If true, this would be very important. But the question is it true? So anyway, there are these two basic lines of argument that you find in the scholarship that enable people to square the circle. The embargo put America and Japan on a collision course. On the other hand, Roosevelt, there's no way Roosevelt wanted war with Japan. Right? They square that circle in these two separate ways. And when you think about that, those are the only two ways in which this can be explained. This could be rationalized. Because if Roosevelt understood what the implications of the embargo were, how it pushed Japan's back against the wall and quite likely lead to a Japanese attack on American forces, if he understood that, and if he was also in charge of policy, controlled policy, basically shaped the policy of the American government, then the policy would have to be viewed as deliberate. That's what deliberate means, right? If you're in control and you do something in full knowledge of what the consequences were, then that's deliberate. So if it's not deliberate, then one or the other of the two following things must be true. Either he did not know what he was doing, or he had lost control of policy. So using that method, we can unpack the argument and examine these particular claims one by one. First, the claim about ignorance. It turns out that Roosevelt understood full well what the implications of the embargo were, that it would drive the Japanese down to the Indies and seize control of the oil-producing areas in the Indies, and that this would mean war with the United States. He said this over and over again. And indeed, prior to July 26, 1941, he had opposed calls for an oil embargo on Japan with the argument that it would lead to force the Japanese down into the Indies and that this would lead to war in the Pacific. Right? So you could dismiss the argument about ignorance. And that leaves you with this argument about loss of control. The bureaucracy had taken over. The Utley. And you look at the historical literature and various sources with the question in mind, is that a valid argument? You know, because if true, as I say, it would be quite extraordinary. And it turns out, no, it's not valid. And there are two basic bodies of evidence that show that the Utley argument is not well-founded. One is certain archival material, very kind of obscure part of the archives that was discovered by another historian named Waldo Heinrichs in a book called Threshold of War. So it turns out, Heinrichs showed that Acheson was taking his orders from Roosevelt's right-hand man, Sumner Welles, and we can presume from that, as Heinrichs points out, that Roosevelt was calling the shots here. Secondly, there are the evidence from the British sources, because when Roosevelt met with Churchill at the Atlantic Conference, you know, just a couple of weeks later, after the embargo was proposed, this issue was discussed, and Roosevelt and Welles made it very clear to their British counterparts that they intended a full embargo and they intended to maintain it in force. What this means is that the policy was deliberate. How then is it to be understood? Roosevelt wanted a war with Japan? Why on earth would he want a war with Japan? Here we go a little bit more into the realm of speculation, but it seems to me the argument is fairly persuasive that the policy that Roosevelt pursued is not to be understood in Asia-specific terms, just in terms of just totally fed up with Japan and wanting to have it out with them, but rather is to be understood in global terms. Roosevelt was too great a statesman to ignore what was going on in Germany. It's true. The military was saying, you shouldn't have this conflict with Japan because our main goal should be to deal with Germany, and this whole thing with Japan is just a diversion. We should concentrate on the real problem. And Roosevelt accepted a lot of the basic assumptions on which that military analysis was built. So if he differed from the military in terms of the conclusions about the sort of policy that should be pursued, especially vis-a-vis Japan, it can only be because a certain set of considerations came into play that shifted the balance in the opposite direction. And that other set of considerations has to be domestic, political in nature, and having to do with Hitler's reluctance to go to war with the United States. He needs to act quickly. That's the argument of the victory program. He accepts that argument. Hitler is not willing to be provoked. Domestic opinion refuses to sanction America going into the war against Germany as an active policy without us being directly attacked. But you could use the Japanese thing as a way of getting the United States into the European war. Because even if Hitler didn't declare war on the United States, the American people had come to view Japan and Germany as part of the same criminal conspiracy. So if Hitler didn't declare war on the United States following a Japanese attack on America, which was expected, not at Pearl Harbor, but probably in the Philippines. If Hitler did not declare war on the United States, Roosevelt would go to the Congress and ask the Congress to declare war on Germany, which was held co-responsible for the Japanese. That's the Roosevelt policy. If that's his policy and you believe it's important for the United States to get into the war with Germany, would you hold that against him? If that was the only way of doing it, would you hold that against him? But if I personally wouldn't. But if that was the policy that he was pursuing, there's a very important implication to be drawn from this. And that's that we pay a big price as a country for failing to think that it's wrong to go to war except if you yourself are attacked. That it's wrong to go to war for essentially political reasons out of a concern with the global structure of power. That we can only go to war if we ourselves are attacked. Because if that's the case, it virtually forces the political leadership to stage manage things in such a way that it would appear to the public that that's the only reason we go to war. So the United States ended up in 1941 as having to fight an essentially unnecessary second war with Japan in order to get into the war to my mind, is a kind of very important conclusions with all kinds of significant implications. But once the United States is in the war, that's it for Germany, right? That's it for both Germany and Japan. The outcome of the war is very, very clear. And so what that means is that what's really important in international politics will be determined by what takes place during the war in terms of relations among the allies and the anti-Axis and coalition. But that's for after the exam. Next time I'll try and pull things together, this whole part of the course, prior to the exam on Friday. Yeah. Oh yeah, please bring blue books. Blue books, yes.